Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, the thread question of the week coming later in the hour. We're in-depth on criminal justice and Native communities. And I'll bet this number will surprise you. More Native Americans per capita are killed in police interactions than African Americans. The Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice also notes that those incidents are rarely reported by the media. Today, as our criminal justice series continues, a look at how justice is and isn't served on reservations and beyond. And I'd like to hear from you this morning. If you work in or advocate in the criminal justice system on reservations or county and state systems at large, I'd like your perspective on the challenges that you encounter for justice and Native people. If you're Native American and you've been a defendant or a victim, did you feel like justice was served? So I'd like to hear experience from people who are in the system, advocate for, are involved with, represent Native people in the criminal justice system. And if you're Native American, you've been a defendant, you've been a victim, do you feel like justice was served in your own experience? The number 800-227-2811, online at nprnews.org/livenews. It's our live blog, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Matthew Fletcher is with us. He's director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University, and he's with us from Tucson. And Matthew, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
Colette Routel is with us. She's co-director, along with Sarah Deer, of the Indian Law Program at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. She's with me in the studio. Colette, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And Jill Dorfler is going to join us a little later. She's listening. She's associate professor and department head of American Indian Studies at the Duluth campus at the University of Minnesota. Colette, those numbers on the fatal interactions between police and Native people are surprising. I'm going to add a little more context to this. A Native person is three times more likely to be killed by a police officer than a white person. Here's my question. Are the same factors at work in those interactions between Native people and law enforcement as they are where we see this with African Americans and other people? Would we find the same reasons for that?
I think you would. There are more similarities than there are differences. When you look at the 21 Native fatalities by police in 2016, they follow a similar story, a similar pattern to a lot of the African-American fatalities that were publicized in the news. There was a deaf man who was shot in North Carolina who wasn't able to hear or understand police commands. Mm-hmm. There were a number of calls to residences where family members had indicated that an individual had mental health issues and was considering suicide, and they were shot when the police arrived at the house. And then, you know, troubling, there were a number of pregnant women who were shot and killed in police interactions over the past year.
What's your understanding about why that number is surprisingly high?
It's not really clear. You know, that's something that varies from year to year, but there was at least one highly publicized in the Native community interaction in Washington State with a pregnant woman who was shot in a car when the police were attempting to arrest her partner, her longtime partner, who had outstanding warrants. And she wasn't armed, and she did not have warrants for her arrest.
Matthew, I'm going to say that as a journalist, I haven't heard of most of these incidents that Colette has just described. And I think you've noted that they don't get much media attention. Why is that?
Well, that's a good question. And I think it has to do with, you know, often the rural character of Indian country. A lot of Indian people live far away from bigger cities, so you're away from a bigger media presence. But I think that, I'm just not an expert in media studies, but my sense is these don't address issues that are expected. They're unusual, and so they're left to the side. They don't sort of fit the media's paradigm of what's going on in terms of interactions between minorities and police.
Matthew, is it your understanding that these interactions are often happening between law enforcement agencies outside of reservations or Native communities and Native people? I mean, is it usually an interaction between a law enforcement person who is not often interacting with that Native community?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say in a lot of instances. Indian country criminal jurisdiction is federalized and has been since the beginning of the United States. And what I mean by that is primarily the United States, the federal government, is the first responder and the lead in terms of taking action and prosecuting crime in Indian country.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are FBI agents. Those are, as the investigators and the United States attorneys from the various districts around the country, as the prosecutors, many times they don't have the kind of interaction with Indian country or experience with Indian country you'd like to see with other first responders. I mean, a county sheriff at least is from that county. And, you know, you can even extend that out to the states because a good 70% of the reservations, mostly the smaller ones, are actually governed by county sheriffs. And again, the county sheriffs are not being elected by the reservation residents. They're being elected by largely non-Indians within the county. And so, again, you don't have the same knowledge background, I suspect, between both the federal and the state governments in relation to Indians in Indian country itself.
Colette, that surprised me that 70% of tribal communities on reservations are under the legal authority of police or law enforcement off of the reservation. What do you think that leads to?
You know, when you have members that aren't part of the community that are policing the community, I think that does create problems. And I'll agree with what Matthew said. My experience stems a lot from running a clinic on the Menominee Indian Reservation in Wisconsin mm-hmm. with students. And in that situation, the tribal police were the individuals that were arresting defendants, and they were mostly members of the tribe. And, you know, it's just anecdotally, but over the course of 2 years, I didn't really hear of instances of police brutality, et cetera. I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the unconscious bias that you see is a big problem when individuals from outside the community are policing mm-hmm. didn't really exist there. Everybody knew everybody, and they were less afraid in the initial interaction and didn't suppose, you know, facts that weren't in existence.
I want to come back to this because this is something that police departments are training for, the conscious and unconscious bias in their interactions with other communities. But I want to grab a call here from Erica in Faribault. Hi, Erica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good,
glad that you
Thank
called.
You.
Yeah. What kind of experience do you bring to this?
Well, I've been working with violence against women for the past 20 years and on the state and also on the federal level. And I know that we've been looking at really dealing with sexual assault in Native American communities, because we know that that's two and a half to three times higher than the instance in the communities. And so we know that specific resources need to be put into the Native communities, because the majority of sexual assaults are happening from non-Native men coming onto the reservations. And we also know that Native women are higher at risk of trafficking and sex trafficking and things like that. So it's a huge issue of violence against women within the Native communities.
You know, Erica, I'm curious about what that means for reporting of because we already know that many, many women who are sexually assaulted never report it to the police. What does it mean when you've got a non-Native person involved in the assault and an investigating agency from outside the reservation?
Correct. Oftentimes things aren't followed up on, or there's, again, no reporting in the first place. And so oftentimes these things never get justice in any sense, either through the criminal justice system or even within the community.
I appreciate the call. You know, Matthew, overall, on trust between the Native community and crime victims, I mean, this is an issue that police departments have been having to confront for a long time. What can you say about what this means in Native communities and on reservations?
Well, you know, it's hard to generalize you know, as we're sitting here talking about how the state and the federal governments tend to react to Indian country crime, we have to remember that even though 70% of reservations are under state jurisdiction, the vast majority of actual Indians are under federal jurisdiction still. And the tribal police and tribal governments still have their own police departments. And I think Colette was pointing out that Menominee and really for most Indians, if not most reservations, the tribal police are going to be the first responders. And there's always, you know, you might actually know those guys. And I'm not really sure that how that is going to help with reporting of sexual assault. And I'm not really sure how that cuts in terms of police response to crime. You know, there's some anecdotal evidence out there, if not statistical evidence, that there's actually a higher degree of police brutality overall, maybe not necessarily directly to killings, but police brutality between victims of police brutality and police, that they actually know each other.
Huh.
If they have a relationship, if there have been multiple arrests, you're more likely to see more police brutality. And I, you know, as someone who has worked on several reservations around the country, anecdotally, I can say that that's absolutely the case. The police know of people. They know, and they're in the back of their minds as somebody who's potentially a target, as, mm-hmm. As a potential threat. And they respond accordingly. They're taught to do so because all tribal police have to be trained and certified by the state in order for their arrests to be acknowledged and recognized by outsiders. So they're trained to act like the rest of the first responders do. And
I was going to say, Colette, to follow on what Matthew was saying, how about the relationship between the tribal police and then these agencies that are outside of the reservation? How does that usually work, and how well does it work?
Yeah, I think it really varies from reservation to reservation. I think one of the things the caller was pointing out was because of the high rates of sexual violence that involve non-Indian defendants committing crimes against tribal members, the problem with that is that the tribal police don't have authority over non-Indian defendants. Unfortunately, due to a U.S. Supreme Court decision in the late 1970s, the tribe can't prosecute non-Indian defendants except under the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization in 2013, under very narrow circumstances where domestic violence is involved and the tribe has to provide public defenders and additional protections, which often it can't due to funding issues. So
That
creates substantial problems in terms of investigation. You're then relying solely on either the federal government or the state government to prosecute.
Right. So Matthew, you've both mentioned the federal government, and you said that most of the law enforcement has been federalized. Isn't the federal system also set up with often tougher penalties for people that have been convicted of crimes? If you're in the federal system, isn't there a higher risk of doing more time if you're convicted? Is that one of the implications of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, it's absolutely true that the federal sentencing guidelines are much stricter and harsher than almost all states, and pretty much across the board. So you're going to go to jail for a lot longer if you're convicted of a federal crime than if you are in state crime. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of cases in the last several decades, if not throughout American history, where an Indian defendant and a non-Indian co-defendant, one is prosecuted in federal court, one is prosecuted by the state, and the non-Indian goes to jail for years less than the Indian person for the exact same crime. That's pretty routine. And because so many Indian people are prosecuted by the federal government, and they really are the only ones that can be prosecuted, you see places, states where the federal criminal docket is, in South Dakota, it's 60% Native people,
right,
even though they're only about 8% of the population. And in Montana, it's about one-third. And
wow,
states that have large reservations, the federal criminal docket is dominated by Indian country crime. And that's because of the federalization of Indian country criminal jurisdiction.
Matthew Fletcher is one of our guests. He's the director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University with us today from Tucson. And Colette Routel is in the studio with me. She's co-director of the Indian Law Program at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. Jill Dorfler listening and going to join us a little later. She's a professor and department head of American Indian Studies at the Duluth campus of U of M. I'm interested in, this is the continuation, by the way, of our criminal justice series. We've talked about a lot of issues that, I should say, really come into play in our conversation today, and I'll discuss that a little more in depth. If you work in or you advocate in the criminal justice system on reservations or off reservations or the county or state system at large, and you advocate for or you represent Native people, again, on reservation or off, I'd like your perspective on the challenges that you've encountered in the criminal justice system. And if you're Native American and you've been a defendant or a victim, do you feel that justice was served? This is a question I've been asking throughout the criminal justice series and hearing some really informative reaction to this. So I'd love to have your view on this today. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Colette, I want to come back to you brought up this issue of bias, conscious and unconscious. One of the things that police departments have been doing, and they've been under pressure to do this, especially after the wake of these police shootings, is train again for this conscious or unconscious bias. What would be the perhaps different biases that a law enforcement officer would bring into an encounter that would specifically speak to Native populations?
Well, I think they're pretty much the same as for other populations of color. And, you know, what's interesting is that it is not necessarily governed by the race of the police officer who's involved as well, too.
That is a surprising thing about this, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, it's something that I know that there are a lot of professors, including my colleague Sarah Deer at Mitchell Hamlin, who, when she teaches criminal law and criminal procedure, has students take one of those unconscious bias tests online. And I think people are always very shocked to realize it comes out with them, you know, tilting in a direction that they certainly didn't think they would.
As unconsciously biased.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
And so that's, you know, to go to what the back and forth that Professor Fletcher and I were having about when you know someone, my understanding of the relationship on the Menominee Reservation was different because the police officers, they knew the people they were arresting as people they went to school with, as people they, you know, hung out with at the grocery store. It was a very small community, whereas oftentimes in these other interactions, the police officer only knows the defendant as somebody they've arrested previously. They have a very different view of them. And then they make those generalizations to entire, racial groups, which is a huge problem.
You know, Matthew, we should say that the police are going to encounter lots of Native people outside of reservations. We have a lot of Native people who live in Minneapolis and other communities around the Twin Cities. What can you say about this issue of unconscious bias in those kinds of interactions?
Well, I think that it's much worse than even on the reservation. And, you know, what you hear about Indian people is that they're all alcoholics, they're all on drugs, they're all poor, and plus they come, you know, the perception is they come from a warrior society, so you better be ready when they get good and liquored up. They're going to come, they're going to bring weapons, and that's the way people perceive Indian people. And this thing about alcoholism and drug abuse is one thing that really shocks me and it saddens me. Even as a young person, I was told that Indian people are somehow innately susceptible to alcoholism and other addictions. And, you know, it turns out the statistics are that Indian people are on poor rural reservations do have alcohol and drug addictions, but no more so than non-Indian people in poor and rural communities. And the same is true for poor populations in, you know, in larger cities. You know, that poverty inevitably leads to addiction and mental illness issues. And but people still perceive Indians as being somehow more susceptible to that, more likely to be, you know, governed by their addictions. And I think that perception is taught to the police. Just recently, the United States Sentencing Commission put out a report. The Tribal Issues Advisory Group put out a report maybe a year or so ago, and they had a list of recommendations, and almost at the top was, and don't forget, 70% of all Indians are alcoholics. I mean, these are, I don't know if these are made up statistics, but they're irrelevant when it comes to policing, right? I mean, 70% is, oh, I think the stat was 70% of all crimes committed by Indians are crimes committed under the influence of alcohol. Well, that's true for all crimes. And I don't know why it has to be highlighted so much for Native people. And I think that that's an unconscious bias. It actually becomes more of a conscious bias.
Right. So what happens?
People don't realize that.
What happens is the law enforcement officer carries that belief into whatever interaction. And maybe that influences mm-hmm. the way that interaction goes.
It does. You know, I can't tell you how many people I've met, usually non-Indians, but Indian people too, from reservation communities who say things like, if it's dark and you see lights on the road, it's going to be a drunk Indian, so get off the road. That's the bias.
We have a caller here who I think is going to speak to this, to John in Duluth. Hi, John.
Hello.
Yeah, hello. What did you want to say about that Matthew was just talking about?
I agree with Matthew. I think they've been stereotyped. The American Native has been stereotyped as, you know, drug addicts, alcoholics, people that have severe addictions. No matter what they try, can't hold their liquor, are angry, are ready to fight. You know, all through our society, you know, with the genocide of the American Native to begin with, when America was, you know, founded, it was like we weren't even human. We were less than the white man, or less than, you know, whatever. So when these FBI agents and sheriffs go onto the reservations to do arrests or to investigate, they're dealing with strangers and think that right away it's a battle. We're going in there, you know, ready to rock and roll. That's what's going to happen, you know, before they even get to know what the situation is. If they had more constables on the reservations, I believe that the constables would know the community and they would deal with the outside sheriffs and FBI instead of them, you know, the outside people directly intervening and all of a sudden taking over the situation. You know, that's where a lot of things happen. You know, they automatically hear he's drunk, or, you know, she's screaming to protect him or saying something, you know, right away they think that somebody's going to pull a knife out or somebody's going to hit somebody with a club, you know, and then they react. It's like they're already trigger happy when they get out there or they get the call.
Yeah. John, thanks very much for the call. Colette, again, I want to say that this may happen on reservations, but these are the kinds of interactions that are happening off reservations as well. And that's, I think, just as dangerous to have law enforcement perhaps come in, maybe have had, I think, as you pointed out, other interactions with an individual and have kind of made up their mind about what that person is going to be and do.
Yeah, I mean, Minneapolis has one of the largest urban Indian populations
right.
in the country. And, you know, it's not an accident. The federal government was pushing Native people to move into cities in the 1950s and 1960s and away from the reservation. And the problem there is that police officers are likely to have less interaction in the city with Native people outside of their performing their job duties. And again, now they're thinking of them only in that context.
Call here from Tammy in Minneapolis. Hi, Tammy. Thanks for
Hello,
waiting.
Good
Hi.
Morning. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I would like to say I agree with, you know, pretty much everything that the other callers are saying. And, you know, it's the perception of what others have of Native American peoples. It's all throughout history. There's historical trauma. If you don't know what that means, please look it up. But as far as for me, I've been in many, many meetings, community meetings with the city officials, neighborhood officials, to try and bridge the gap between the tension between the police and the community. And my biggest thing is education for the police officers. And that goes for Somali community, African community, Native American community. You have to know who you're dealing with. And so I believe that if you know more about a person, you would have less judgment. But as far as officials, the judicial system, police having judgment against the community, mm-hmm. let me also highlight that 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds, 4-year-olds, when they see their parents, their aunts, their uncles being abused by police officers, they are automatically going to have their own perception. And for the future, how will that bring the kids', you know, opinion of the police? Will they want to become the police? I don't think so.
All right.
So I believe that we need to just, you know, it's about unity, but how does that start? We can be in meetings upon meetings upon meetings. But, you know, I believe it starts with the community, and the communities need to stand up and help ourselves.
Tammy, I really appreciate the call. And I think this is a good moment to bring Jill in. She's an associate professor and department head of American Indian Studies at UMD. Hey, Jill. Hi.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you.
Someone was tweeting from UMD to remind me that it is not Duluth campus. So thank you, whoever is tweeting on that. And good to have you on the phone here, Jill, and listening. Tell me what you make of what Tammy just said.
I absolutely agree with what Tammy just said and what Colette and Matthew have both been saying as well. When it comes to conscious and unconscious bias, the need for education, not only about conscious and unconscious bias, but I would add the need for police officers to have an understanding of Native history, of federal government policies. The legacies of those policies continue to impact our families and communities today. And for those officers also to have an understanding of contemporary tribal sovereignty and other issues. I think for most people, that is erased from their education. We know from studies of textbooks that 88% or so of textbooks in high school don't mention American Indians after 1900.
Wow.
And so, so things like that are shocking. So in many ways, the officers are just operating off of the biases that we see replicated in dominant society, largely in the media and in other areas of popular culture. So there's a huge need for education for them to really to see Native people as people, as humans.
Matthew, would you say something on this Native sovereignty issue? This has been an ongoing, I mean, this ends up in our legislative debates here. This has been an ongoing conversation in Minnesota and our part of the country. And I wonder what you would say about law enforcement agencies having a better awareness of that.
Well, I think that, you know, there's an enormous lack of education in the U.S. overall, and especially when it comes to Native people. So a lot of people don't realize that tribes predate the United States. I mean, they were here before, and tribes in Minnesota especially live still in the traditional homelands of their ancestors. So it's their home, and they've been there a lot longer. And so they've been exercising this kind of jurisdiction and dealing with these issues for centuries before there was a United States. And what we miss, unfortunately, by focusing on criminal law as a solution to reservation ills, mm-hmm. is that the reservation ills are usually directly tied to the United States stripping tribes of a lot of their power or undermining them by cutting off their land and resources. And, you know, we have lots of poverty in Indian country and social ills that are directly tied to that, and that leads to crime. But it seems to me that, generally speaking, the only solution that the United States is willing to consider is to lock more people up in jail as a response, rather than dealing with the sovereignty issues, the issues that, you know, tribal governments really do need the power and the capacity to govern their reservations.
Matthew, really a pleasure to have you on the line. I know it's early in Arizona, so I'm really grateful that you made some time for us this morning. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Matthew Fletcher is director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center at Michigan State University. Colette Routel continues with us from Mitchell Hamlin School of Law, and Jill Dorfler continues with us from UMD. And I'm asking to hear from you as we continue our criminal justice series this morning. We talk about interactions between law enforcement and Native people and what happens once you get into the criminal justice system. This is something I haven't focused on too much, but I want to talk to our guests about this as well, because we heard through the series a lot on the inequity in the criminal justice system for people of color. I want to ask Colette and Jill about that as well. If you work in or you advocate in the criminal justice system in some ways through the county, the state, the federal system, or on reservations, I'd love to have your perspective on the challenges that you encounter. If you're Native American and you've been a defendant or a victim, or you have a view on criminal justice, I think your thoughts would be very valuable to the discussion today. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter, at CarrieNPR, and Steph is on the live blog. Hey, Steph, what are you hearing?
Hi, Amy wrote in. She says, Native American victims of rape don't report because we don't get results. I had to wait 4.5 years for the Duluth Police Department to even test my rape kit. They didn't test a single rape kit of any Native woman over an extremely long period of time. Why should we report?
Back to your calls and your insights on this on the other side of news to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. Big news for Indian country this morning. President Trump is expected to sign executive orders today restarting the Dakota Access and Keystone Oil Pipeline projects. Both projects were put on hold by the Obama administration. Protesters have camped near a Dakota Access river crossing site for months. That site is near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. This morning, Trump met with the heads of General Motors, Ford, and Fiat Chrysler. He says his focus is creating and keeping jobs. For more than two decades, Mexico has been an oasis for the auto industry, and Trump has threatened a substantial border tax on companies that move their manufacturing out of the U.S. Two of Trump's picks to serve in his administration face questioning on Capitol Hill today. Congressman Mike Mulvaney of South Carolina is Trump's pick to lead the White House Budget Office, and another Senate committee will question Congressman Tom Price of Georgia, Trump's nominee for health secretary. Moments ago, a Senate committee approved Ben Carson as housing secretary, and Reuters is reporting that President Trump plans to keep FBI Director James Comey in his post. That's even though Comey was criticized by both Republicans and Democrats for his actions leading up to the election. Britain's Supreme Court says the Prime Minister must get approval from Parliament before starting the Brexit process. The court also ruled Britain does not have to consult Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland before starting the process to leave the European Union. And the musical La La Land has landed a record-tying 14 Oscar nominations. They include a nod for Best Picture. Other Best Picture nominees are Moonlight, Arrival, Manchester by the Sea, Hell or High Water, Lion, Fences, Hidden Figures, and Hacksaw Ridge. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
We start every Monday, every week, with a conversation about politics. We start with the political junkie, and then we talk about what's been happening. Barely able to cram that into an hour. If you missed our conversation yesterday at 9 o'clock, find it on my podcast, NPR News with Carrie Miller, on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And I want to remind you, Indivisible at 7 p.m., a new public radio national call-in coming from Minnesota Public Radio on Thursday nights, and me. I hope you'll listen in and you'll call in. 7 p.m., Indivisible.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11 on NPR News, an update on Governor Dayton's health as he prepares to deliver his budget today. And our Counter Stories hosts discuss the movie Hidden Figures. Join us at 11.
Support comes from St. Jude Medical Foundation, the philanthropic arm of St. Jude Medical, a global medical device company headquartered in St. Paul, changing lives worldwide through grants and volunteerism for education, patient support, and healthy communities. SJM.com.
Back to our conversation now, but I do want to acknowledge here that it is confirmed that President Trump will sign these executive orders on the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone Pipeline. Colette, this is something that we talked about before we came on the air. You said, maybe I should ask you, what's your sense of what the executive orders will do? And then we'll talk about the reaction.
Well, it's just speculation at this point, but it could be that President Trump is indicating that they're not going to move forward with the environmental impact statement that the Obama administration indicated was going to be completed before approving the Dakota Access pipeline. So that would be a major shift and a big blow to Native communities.
And you say that because this would mean, with the issue at Dakota Access, it crosses the land that the protesters were trying to stop it from crossing.
That's correct. There's basically only one piece of the pipeline that's left to be completed, and that's the piece that could really impact water resources for the Standing Rock Reservation, and that's where the protest has congregated, basically. And so any executive order is likely going to be tied to that.
Jill, do you have a sense of what may happen with the signing of this executive order among Native communities? I mean, are we going to see more protesters headed back to Standing Rock?
I don't know. I think that it's speculation at this point as well. I believe the Standing Rock Tribal Council yesterday or very recently did order that everyone go ahead and remove.
Yeah, they did. You're right.
So I'm not sure whether the protesters will respect that order from the Tribal Council. The protesters, of course, are independent individuals, organized, but not official arm of tribal government in any way. And yet I know many of them have worked very hard to be respectful of the tribe and carrying out, in part, the tribe's wishes. So I think perhaps we'll see a removal from the site, but ongoing protests maybe in other ways, maybe in urban areas. I know there's been a targeting of banks and some urban protests, so maybe we'll see more of that.
Colette, I think you said that there are other court cases, though, being pursued in courts outside of North Dakota. I think you said there's some pending in Washington?
That's correct. Because this is a federal action or it requires federal approval, the agency can be sued in the location where the pipeline is being constructed or in Washington, D.C. And the Standing Rock Tribe is represented by Earth Justice in litigation that's pending right now in D.C. The issue, how that ties in with the protests, is if the government authorizes the construction of the pipeline, it's going to be built until the court says you have to stop.
Okay.
And so, the problem here is attorneys work to try to get an injunction which would stop the construction of the pipeline until the court has an opportunity to review the legality of construction. But oftentimes that won't come quick enough. And that's where the civil disobedience side comes. The hope is to prevent construction, to give the court time to actually review the legality of the project.
So this is going to appear to allow the construction to continue. And you're saying as these cases kind of grind through the courts, it may not, to get an injunction, may not come quickly enough to stop the bulldozers and the construction that's going to start up again. If these orders are what we think they're going to be.
It's a common problem. I represented a little tribe in Nevada a few years ago, the Summit Lake Paiute tribe, that was similarly trying to stop a pipeline that was being constructed just north of its reservation. And they had a lot of concerns about the environment, about their water resources, about sacred sites. And unfortunately, the pipeline was built through the area despite our requests for an injunction before we could get a decision from the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit, sort of indicated that they were going to rule in our favor on those issues. But at that point, the area had already been bulldozed. And so the question was moot. And I think that's what protesters are trying to stop. They're trying to, pursue legal remedies. But to do that, you need to stop construction.
They need the time to try to pursue the legal remedies. I should say that President Trump, due to sign these executive orders at 10 o'clock Central Time, 11 o'clock Eastern Time, and we'll have more news on that. A call here, I think, about this to Michael in Northfield. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Thank you for calling attention to these important issues,
sure.
And thanks for securing fabulous panelists. I've been actually on hold for a while, and I actually heard the report come out from NPR about the executive order signing, and I was actually about to ask about the sort of criminal jurisdiction sort of issues that were on display for all of America in Morton County at Cannonball and the camps. And wanted to ask the panelists how the kinds of bias and the sort of irrational response to peaceful protesters as criminals, as trespassers, as sort of dangerous that need to be protected. How this conversation helps frame our understanding of that issue.
Michael, thank you for the question. Jill, would you tackle that first, and then I'll go to Colette on this. What was your perception of that?
Sure. Yeah, I'll give a brief thing and then turn over to the attorneys for their expert. I appreciate that comment from Michael. Yeah, I think that, as we said, really violence related to American Indians, police violence against American Indians has been underreported. But Standing Rock has, in some ways, kind of shined a light on what has been going on. And we do see police there acting in a manner that is really over the top for peaceful protesters, many people would say. And it goes back to those biases, and it goes back to seeing Native people as a threat. Native people have always been a threat and an undermining in some ways to U.S. sovereignty and that kind of dominant narrative in America. And so when we see Native people talking about sovereignty, talking about their treaty rights, wanting the U.S. to uphold some of its obligations, there can be, as we've seen, a really violent reaction to that. And U.S. has been, I think, waiting and wanting Native peoples to disappear really since the revolution, and it hasn't happened. And there's a kind of frustration that Native people are still here. There's a huge frustration that the U.S. is expected to uphold its treaty obligations, and we see the police acting on that.
Colette, Jill, thanks. Colette, I just want to say before you respond to that, the militarization of police departments has been an issue for a long time, and you know that there was a lot of criticism for the way that police departments reacted to other peaceful protests. Is it different, do you think, in these interactions between Native American protesters and law enforcement agencies? Did you see something different happening, for example, at Standing Rock?
It seemed much more aggressive than what we're used to in urban areas. And I think a lot of that does have to do with the rural nature of it.
Meaning what?
You know, I think today in urban areas, police are just they're much more aware of the fact that there are cell phones all over the place, that there are cameras all over the place. And today, you know, that's really what's shined a light on police interactions with communities of color, is being able to prove the converse. And so you certainly have police in North Dakota that have been arguing that these aren't peaceful protests, that the protesters, you know, are engaging in violent actions. And I have many friends and colleagues that have been up there that would say quite the opposite. It's just that there is less of a, for a long time, there was less of a media presence. There was less of the sort of being able to prove your side, because of the remoteness of the area. And you really only saw the media take note of a lot of the violence when you were able to get video of showing water cannons on protesters, or the young woman who is non-native from, I think, New York State, who almost had her arm blown off by a concussion grenade. Those are the types of actions that then the media really took notice of.
Steph, off the page.
Raj says, I worked for a group home in Arizona, and the Native kids we had were very distrustful of us, as well as their families. Honestly, I don't blame them for that mentality, considering what I witnessed of the negative attitudes toward them and their Native community from some in the group home. And then we also had somebody write in from the Legal Rights Center saying that Native American children are significantly overrepresented in Minnesota's juvenile justice system and are placed out of home in secure placements at a significantly higher rate than white youth.
I think we have Anita calling in from Brainerd. Anita, you wanted to talk about that as well, didn't you? Kids in foster care from Native communities?
Yes. Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've spent more than the past 30 years working with Native youth in foster care. Thank you for that segue. I just want to say that Minnesota has the largest overrepresentation of Native children in foster care in the country. And these foster children often go on to have high rates of incarceration. They're often called crossover youth. And these are youth that are in foster care and also involved in the juvenile justice system. This overrepresentation starts before the criminal justice system, and we need to go upstream, so to speak, and strengthen families. The involvement in both the foster care system and the criminal justice system is also linked to the higher levels of poverty in these communities.
Is this something? Thank you, Anita. Is this something, Colette, that you've seen?
Yes, and I think that was Judge former White Earth Judge Anita Finde on the line.
Oh my gosh, Anita, I didn't realize that. I wish you would have identified yourself as such, but thank you for the call. You're going to add, Colette.
Yeah, you know, one of our prior callers also mentioned the issue of historical trauma, and I think that's important for people to realize that how past governmental policies are really impacting communities today. When you look historically at the government forcing Indian children, taking them away from their families and sending them to boarding schools in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and the continuation of that program in the 50s and 60s with the Indian Adoption Project, you have whole generations of Native people that have not been able to grow up in a family environment, and also that rightfully are very distrustful of state and federal workers. And so that really complicates the problem of providing intervention and services here.
Are you at the law center that you're involved with training young advocates to go back into Native communities and perhaps go back into reservations to address the kinds of things that we've been talking about?
Certainly in our Indian law program, we really hope to target Native people that wish to go back and serve their community. And we do have a number of recent grads who are now working in-house for various tribes, like Veronica Newcomer, who was handling the Indian child welfare caseload at the White Earth Band of Ojibwe.
Okay. Colette, good to have you on the show. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Jill, thank you. Really good to hear from you, from UMD this morning.
Thank you.
UMD proud, right?
Yes.
Thanks. And our criminal justice series continues next week, next Tuesday.